I'm very, very honored tonight to be able to introduce our two speakers. Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein is a philosopher, scholar, and an award-winning novelist. Her latest novel is 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a work of fiction. Her books include the novels The Mind-Body Problem, Properties of Light, and Mazel, and nonfiction studies of Kurt Gödel and Spinoza. A recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship in 1996, Goldstein has also received Guggenheim and Radcliffe Fellowships and is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. I'm also very honored to introduce Steven Pinker. He is Harvard College professor and Johnston Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard University. Pinker is one of the world's leading authorities on language and the mind, and the author of 7 books, including The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, Words and Rules, The Blank Slate, and The Stuff of Thought. He is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, honorary president of the Canadian Psychological Association, and the recipient of 6 honorary doctorates. Steve is a 3-time winner of the William James Book Prize, and he has won many prizes for his other books and research. Far too many for me to mention here, or we would not have time to hear much from our two speakers. Our two speakers have been called America's Brainiest Couple by Salon.com magazine. And they have been very, very dedicated in their enthusiasm for Penn New England and have contributed much to the organization over the years. And right before we get started, let me just tell you that we're going to hear from our two speakers. And there will be time for questions from the audience afterwards, so please think of some good questions to ask them. And then after the event is over, books are available for purchase in the back. So let's welcome Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein and Steven Pinker.
Well, I'd like to start by thanking Penn New England for sponsoring this event and to thank all of you for coming. And because it's a Penn event, I'll start off with a literary question about the motive for writing this particular book. Now, both of us have been dragged into the faith, reason, atheist, science debates kind of sideways. I wrote a book called How the Mind Works, which was not about religion, but it did have a brief discussion on the psychology of religion, why people believe weird things. And it also took a naturalist view of the mind. The mind is what the brain does, no soul, no afterlife. And then, despite myself, I found myself getting embroiled in humanist, atheist, freethinker organizations. And you had a similar experience having written the biography of Spinoza, the patron saint of atheism, perhaps. And so both of us ended up in this brouhaha, which was really stoked by the bestsellers by Christopher Hitchens, Dan Dennett, Sam Harris. Why did you think that this topic needed a novel at this point? What was... Why another atheist book, and why a fiction book?
Well, as you well know, when you first met me, I had said, I will never write another novel. I had sworn to everybody who wanted to hear or who didn't want to hear that I would never write another novel. The last novel I had written had been Properties of Light, a novel of love betrayal and quantum physics. And surprisingly, it didn't sell very well. Scientists weren't interested in it because it was a novel, and literary people were, you know, scared away because it was about quantum mechanics, which it was. So I thought I would do really popular things like Gödel's Incompleteness Theorem or Spinoza, right? I enjoyed writing these nonfiction books very much, and it seemed to me, as I told you, punishing to write novels. People don't take them seriously as intellectual works, and those are the only kind of novels I'm interested in writing. And And Lord knows, as my career as a philosopher is only hurt by writing these novels. You know, philosophers don't take novels seriously. So I was not going to do it. But you broached on it, my getting pulled into this debate, this atheism debate, and, you know, discovering that non-religion was almost as organized as religion, that when you and I got invited to all of these foundations and societies, associations of free thinkers, I kept saying to you, something very vital is being left out of this discussion, that the more I was speaking to people with whom you and I both agree, free thinkers, non-believers, the more dissatisfied I felt when they would discuss what it's like, what it feels like to be a believer, which is something I know very well. I come from a very religious background and have lived that life. I kept thinking, somebody has to write a novel about this, because only novels can get at the way that beliefs and feelings, emotions, are so interconnected, that it's not just about arguments, but it's about one's entire orientation toward the world. Somebody's got to write this. Somebody who thinks exactly the same way I do about everything has got to write this. Yes, and you kept pushing me too. He wanted me to write another novel. I sometimes think that's why you married me, was to make me write another novel. But you were very gung-ho about this.
So, in a way, this is in the tradition of the hero of both of us, William James, namesake of the building in which I work, and a man who lived down the street from where we are and maybe walked this very building. Yes. Is there a portrait of him here? I guess not. No, we've got Teddy Roosevelt, but not William James.
Yeah.
In what way is the...
and you, of course, have been called the William James of our day. Let's not forget.
I've been called worse.
Yeah.
In what way was William James's... the varieties of religious experience and inspiration for some of the themes of this novel?
Well, of course, James was soft on religion. He wanted to be a believer. In terms of our attitude toward the philosophy of the situation, maybe not so much. But his care and attention to the phenomenology of religion, what it feels like, and how complicated it is. There's no such thing as a religious personality. There are so many different personalities. I mean, he distinguished between the sort of melancholic, the soul-sick religiosity, and the optimistic religiosity. But that there is that is very complicated. That there are different personalities that are attracted to religion, and that religion expresses itself differently in different psychologies. That was a great inspiration to at least my main character.
And so the book, by exploring what it's like to be in the throes of a religious experience, is more sympathetic to the religious mindset than the atheist bestsellers. And I have seen in reviews and heard in interviewers people saying, well, it's kind of a compromise between atheism and faith. It's kind of a little of this and it's a little of that, and it avoids the extremes and it avoids the polarized debates.
Making nice. Yes.
So is it kind of, God kind of exists, maybe exists, some days he exists in some ways, not others. Is that, I mean, are you comfortable being slotted in as the great compromiser?
No, I'm not a compromiser. I'm a little reluctant to answer this question for this reason. It pleases me when people who think very different from the way that I do about these issues read the book and somehow feel their experience being done justice to. And you know, because, I mean, you were at this dinner that was organized by the Templeton Foundation and a bunch of thinkers, and depending where they were coming from, they read the book differently, either as a great vindication of the religious sensibility or as quite the contrary. And I like that. I like, that's one of the things I love about the novel, that readers bring their own experience to it. And so I don't want to say so much what I... But you're going to push me.
Yes. Well, the appendix to the novel, which, and I should mention that the novel is about a psychologist of religion who has written an atheist bestseller. The appendix to his book, which is also the appendix to Rebecca's book, consists of 36 arguments for the existence of God and their refutations. So the appendix is pretty uncompromising.
Yeah.
And how does that leave room for the ambiguity that I suppose your protagonist, as well as some of the reviewers, have seen in it?
Yeah. Well, you know, when it comes to this belief, I mean, here's one thing that Cass Seltzer, at least, is uncompromising on. He doesn't think of, you know, faith as an alternative means to knowledge. You know, there's faith and there's reason. This is, so that kind of response to religiosity, he is completely against, as am I. I mean, faith is just, for me, an excuse for having no reason to believe, and this is not another hero of ours. I think he's a hero of yours, Bertrand Russell. I mean, or someone we like.
Yes.
I don't know if he's a hero.
Bertrand Russell believed some weird things.
Yes,
too,
yes, this is true. Well, he lived so long, he went through every viewpoint that you can possibly go through. You know, he said that, you know, faith has all the advantage over reason that theft has over labor, you know, and this is, I've always liked. But there are, and this is, again, very much in the spirit of William James, that there are large emotions that can be expressed religiously or not. I mean, that's one of the big themes of my life as a Spinozist, and I think yours as well, that these sort of transcendent, sublime experiences that I call ontological wonder, just wonder at existence, it's very natural to express them religiously. And in that sense, I have a great sympathy for them. I think they can also be expressed in purely secular terms, so that it's not that we're not bereft of those experiences. I think it is, and actually I should ask you as a psychologist, I think it is part of our psychological inheritance. Do you?
Yeah, I think there are things that puzzle us for which religious solutions feel very compelling. And the first person I think who articulated it was an anthropologist writing in the 19th century, Edward Tyler, who argued that, I mean, he didn't put it the way I'll put it, but before the age of neuroscience, the idea that we all have immaterial souls was actually a pretty good theory. It explained a lot of data, such as, what's the deal with dreaming? Your body is in bed, but some part of you is up and about in the world. What happens when someone dies? They're walking and talking and seeing, and then all of a sudden the body is still there, but it looks like some kind of energy that was animating it is gone. What is a reflection? And if you have no appreciation of physics, it's got your energy, it's got your movement, it's got your form, but it's doesn't weigh anything. You can't hold it, or a shadow. What happens when you go into a trance from a drug or delirium or fever, and again, you have an out-of-body experience? So there's a hypothesis that actually ties all these observations together, namely that each of us is a body and a soul, and they can part company. They do when you dream, and your soul looks back at you from reflections and shadows. It parts company from the body permanently when a person dies, and it's not a bad theory. I mean, we now have a theory that's better, namely neuroscience, cognitive neuroscience, but just as I think Richard Dawkins once said that before Darwin, it would be perfectly logical to be a believer in God, because the argument from design was pointed to a genuine phenomenon in need of an explanation, and a divine artificer was the only one available. So Darwin made it possible to be not to be a creationist. And I think in the same way, cognitive neuroscience, for the first time, makes it possible not to be a dualist. That is, that there is an alternative to the soul theory, as good as the soul theory was in its day in trying to account for these phenomena, which everyone experiences. It's another case, I think, where the progress of science has whittled away some of the intuitive support that used to be part of the religious belief system. Now, that's belief in souls isn't the only part of religion, but it's certainly, I think if you wanted to look at cross-culturally, what do religions have in common? I mean, they don't have the Trinity, they don't have Ten Commandments, but what, for us to call a belief religion, it would probably have to have some kind of dualism. No? Or Judaism, maybe not?
Judaism, I mean, yeah. early Judaism did not have a belief in the afterlife. It came in post-Christianity.
And God himself?
A philosopher was just saying to me, you know, you call this a religion, you don't even have the afterlife, what good is that? But the mother religion did not have a clear concept of the afterlife.
And what about God himself? I mean, he didn't have a body, presumably?
God himself. There's some controversy about that. There's some controversy about that. I mean, actually, one of the reasons for Spinoza's excommunication, Spinoza was excommunicated by his own Jewish community of 17th century in Amsterdam, was that he said that that God could have a body. So by that time, there was a kind of doctrine. But as you well know, I mean, Judaism steers clear of metaphysical doctrines, and it's much more concentrated on the law, and it knows better than very practical,
very behaviorist.
Very behaviorist. Yes,
if you do the right things, then it doesn't matter. There are no mental representations.
Exactly.
Or at least if there are, it's kind of don't ask, don't tell.
Yeah, and if you confess to your parents, I don't think I really believe in God. It's like, okay, just keep kosher, and it's who cares? It's different that way. So it's not these metaphysical questions are not.
Right.
It was post-Christianity that Judaism got, I think, a little more self-conscious about it all and tried to whip up some theology.
You still can't get a straight story about the afterlife, though. Whether there's a hell or heaven, all these basic things that just
I mean, it's really in the superstitions. You know, there's of course hell. I mean, Gehenna, and tons of demons and imps. Isaac Bashevis Singer, land. Right. But this is superstitious stuff. This is not rabbinical Judaism.
Well, I remember my colleague Daniel Bell. The eminent sociologist telling the story of when he was having his bar mitzvah lessons, he said to the rabbi, I've given it a lot of thought, and I've decided that I just don't believe in God. And the rabbi said, you think God cares? You brought up Spinoza a couple of times.
Yeah.
And
this is a theme in the book, belief not really mattering all that much in Judaism.
Or in religion, I suppose,
or in
general.
It's not exactly.
There's we know a philosopher, Loyal Rue, who wrote a book called Religion is Not About God.
Right.
And that seems to be one of the themes of the novel.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just about God, I would say. God gets in every once in a while.
Now, you brought up Spinoza, and one of the many things that I've learned from you is that my idea and everyone's idea of Spinoza was all wrong. Because whenever you mention Spinoza, the first paired associate response that people have is Spinoza, pantheism, which means that he believed in God, but God was kind of a New Age interpretation of Spinoza. God is in the flowers and the butterflies and the sunshine and the brooks and the mountains and so on. But
right.
I have learned that that is, even though that's what everyone thinks Spinoza said, it's at least your interpretation, a total misreading. Would you?
Well, and the right interpretation.
but
yes.
Maybe you could get people to stop thinking pantheism when they think Spinoza, if you tell them what he meant.
Well, I mean, actually, since this is a pan event, this is an interesting story. As you know, I mean, this summer is the first time I discovered that it was the literary artists that turned Spinoza into this pantheist, this nature lover, you know, that you get close to God by going on a hike. So I only have approached Spinoza as a philosopher. I never thought about the literary uses of Spinoza, but I was asked to write a chapter for the new Oxford Handbook on Spinoza, and they asked me to write on the literary influences of Spinoza, which turned out to be just extraordinary. You know that I was like going crazy this summer reading everything because everybody was influenced by Spinoza. You know, George Eliot and Herman Melville, Emerson, you know, right in our own neighborhood here. But the most fascinating thing was that what happened 100 years after his death with Lessing and Moses Mendelssohn and this guy named Jacobi. And he accused Lessing of being a closet Spinozist, which was the worst thing you could possibly be. I mean, because it not only meant, you know, you were an atheist, but you removed all grounds for believing in God, because Spinoza had an answer for why is there something rather than nothing, and he had an answer for, you know, what is morality. His great work is called The Ethics, and he tries to ground morality on human nature. It's taken us a long time to catch up to this, but, you know, he was dead on. And so he was seen as, you know, just the worst kind of Satan's emissary. In fact, to get anywhere in academia, you had to come up with new arguments against Spinoza. I mean, that was part of, like, you know, showing. It was so. So Jacobi, in trying to attack the Enlightenment, which had finally sort of begun to flower, seeded, of course, by Spinoza, decided to attack these Enlightenment figures by saying they're Spinozists, therefore atheists, therefore immoral, therefore fatalists, you know, therefore Satan's emissaries. And what happened, and this was in Germany, Jacobi was a convert from Judaism to Christianity, very, very zealot, I mean, very, he was just the kind of guy who would challenge us to a debate now, you know, about God's existence, very strongly theistic. And what happened was all these German romantics, who are the farthest thing from Spinoza that it could possibly be, Goethe and Heine and all of these romantics who revel, who wallow in emotion and all the things that Spinoza is against, stood up and said, "They're Spinozists. I'm Spinozist. I'm Spinozist." And what they did was, Spinoza had identified God with nature, and what he meant by nature were the laws of nature, the final theory of everything, the kind of thing that a string theorist talks about now, like the final theory that would explain not only what the laws of nature are, but why they had to be those laws of nature, and why they had to realize themselves in existence. This very abstract notion, not the burbling brooks and the whispering pines. Mathematics is what he was talking about, the mathematical theory that would explain everything. But he said, God is nature, meaning by nature that, it's. But to a romantic soul, it meant something entirely different. So it was these romantic poets who turned him into this false view that you had until I enlightened you.
Well, one other thing that that you enlightened me about, which was when I was writing The Blank Slate, I was dealing with the political and emotional and moral colorings of the concept of human nature, of the idea that there is such a thing as human nature, that the mind is a product of the brain, the brain is a product of evolution, an idea which is just second nature, if you'll pardon the expression, to anyone in cognitive science or neuroscience, but which turns out to have all of these, press all of these hot buttons. And when I wrote How the Mind Works, I was expecting a fair amount of opposition from the kind of academic left who has long been skittish about the notion of human nature. But I was blindsided by the fact that I got even more bitter attacks from the right, because the idea that we aren't given a soul by God, that we that our moral intuitions are themselves evolutionary adaptations, that they don't have any reality that was given to us by God. The criticism was that this was an amoral worldview that would make anything permissible because there were no external grounds for deeming anything right or wrong. It's just a hunch, a feeling, an emotion, a gut feeling, with no more content or substance or truth than whether or I like the taste of sugar or the sound of a harmonic chord.
I mean, having survival value, clearly, which is why we evolved them,
The criticism was that if that's all there were to it, if there were survival value to rape and murder and commit genocide, then that would be okay according to an evolutionary ethic because there's no external grounding for morality other than from religion. And a theme of the debate that's the centerpiece of your novel, there's a debate in there, takes place at Harvard, well, resolved, God exists, in which the protagonist debates a Nobel Prize-winning economist who is, with many neoconservatives, is so opposed to anything associated with the left that he's embraced the religious worldview as part of an overall conservatism. But what the debate ultimately comes down to is exactly this issue, namely, does morality have any grounding other than commandments from God? And one of the things I learned from you, and perhaps you'll share with everyone else, is how arguments from Spinoza and others show the fallacy in this line of thought. I guess Plato even earlier.
Yeah, it's Plato. Yeah, it really goes all the way back to Plato and his dialogue, the Euthyphro. And so there are two parts to this question. One is, does the hypothesis of God, of God's will grounding morality, does that help in any way? And then the second part is, after you've shown that it doesn't help, well, then how do we do it? And that's, so those are two very separate issues. But the first part, does, God help in any way? The basic argument really does go back to Plato and the Euthyphro. Of course, he talked about the gods rather than God. But it's the same argument, and I think it's just a knockdown argument. And it is, what happens, is there's a conversation between Euthyphro and Socrates, and Euthyphro is doing something in a very self-righteous way. He's bringing his father to court, and for doing something wrong. And Socrates says, "Oh, just the guy I want. You're going to explain to me what it is that makes something right or wrong." And Euthyphro says, in his self-righteous way, it's what the gods want us to do. I know that I'm doing the right thing because this is what God would want me to do. And Socrates says, there's no reason other than that. No, there's no reason other than that. God wants me to do this, and that's what makes it right. Murder is wrong because God doesn't want me to do this. And then Socrates says, and does God have a reason for this? And Euthyphro says, what do you mean? God either has a reason or God doesn't have a reason. It's logic, right? If God has a reason for not wanting you to commit murder, that's the reason. And God is irrelevant. And if God has no reason whatsoever, it's just a whim, he could just as well have reversed it and said, go commit genocide, or, you know, go wear your pants backwards on Friday, or, you know, anything. How does that answer our question, what makes this moral? It's just a capricious whim of an amoral God because there's no morality independent. So either God doesn't give us morality, or we already have it, and he's irrelevant, he's redundant. And that is an argument that goes back to Plato. And philosophers have always taken it very, very seriously. And so they have tried, and they have done a very good job of grounding morality, of trying to show what are the intuitions that actually... And so that's the second part. And that I can't... It would be hard to give a really short answer because it's the history of moral philosophy. That's what moral philosophy is about. And we've made progress. In the same way that we've made progress scientifically, we've made progress in moral philosophy and have pulled religion along, which is why even the most religious among us read the Bible and will say, oh, but of course we don't mean really that slavery.
Where God actually does command people to commit genocide.
Yes, he really does.
Many times.
But no, you know, or, you know, we're not going to stone the adulteress and we're not going to... slavery is wrong, and you know, how do they know this? It was a secular society. It was moral philosophy that was making this progress and pulling religion along with it. So quite the contrary, I would say.
But Spinoza, though, did... I mean, he had a phrase which your protagonist cites, which does capture one way of rationalizing morality, the... viewpoint of eternity
Some speculative.
Aside from the fact that you gave the Euthyphro argument says why you can't get morality from religion.
Exactly.
And the second part would be, well, where do you get it?
Where do you get it? Well, that's long. That's long. You know,
I talk about it in the book,
right?
Yeah.
It starts with, look, if you're committed to yourself, and you're committed, and we all are. Right? We all pursue our lives and think that they're worth pursuing and want ourselves to survive and to flourish and have certain moral emotions when people interfere with our surviving and our flourishing. We have something, moral outrage. If I'm lying on a beach... And you're walking, and I'm between where you are and where you want to get to, and you just step on my stomach, right? Because you know you just want to get from one place to the other. I'm going to be really angry and say to you, "How could you have done that? It would have been so easy for you to get around." And yet, does my suffering matter not at all to you? If you ever have an emotion of that sort, and who doesn't? I mean, that's part of our arsenal, right? Our psychological arsenal. What moral philosophy, what Kant and what Spinoza and what Aristotle and what Plato and up to Tom Nagel, you know, possibility of altruism, will do, will work on you and show you that logically you have to widen your reasons for action so that other people's suffering also provide reasons for action. I mean, that's the... And it, you know, it's summed up actually in the Golden Rule. You know, have others treat others as you would wish to be treated. I mean, that is so. If you don't care how you're treated by others, then moral philosophy has nothing to say to you. But if you care, moral philosophy can go to work on you and appeal to your reason, at least. That's the history of moral philosophy.
In a nutshell. I remember you when we first met, and I was struggling with this argument in the blank slate. So I had my own little moment of divine coincidence, because after you explained this, and I was trying to figure out how do I recreate this in my own simple-minded way for in this book, and I went jogging in Fresh Pond, and as I went around the track, you know, Fresh Pond has these bulletin boards where they have various notices. They have, you know, the nature tours and the maps. And I remember one time there was a notice that said, contrary to what we posted last week, it is not true that a three-year-old child was carried away by a red-tailed hawk. I remember that. Which is reassuring. But that isn't why I'm bringing up this story. Because another time, posted on this bulletin board, was a cartoon from the late-lamented Calvin and Hobbes comic strip. So you cite Plato and Spinoza. I cite the comics.
That's why you sell better than me.
But it was perfect. I realized that as soon as I read this, that the Bill Waterston must have been channeling this argument, because there was Calvin saying, well, I don't believe in ethics anymore. It's a dog-eat-dog world. The strongest wins. So I'll just look out for myself, and I'll let other people worry about its whether it's, quote, moral or not. And then Hobbes shoves him into the mud, and he protests. He said, why did you do that? And Hobbes says, well, you were in my way. The ends justify the means. And Calvin says, I didn't mean for everyone, you idiot, just me.
Exactly.
And Hobbes goes, aha. So Hobbes is aha, not the philosopher Hobbes, the tiger Hobbes. Captured it, and I got permission to reprint that comic strip in the book, and I use it in my lectures.
Yeah, it's a brilliant comic strip, yes.
Now, your novel is, much of it is set here at Harvard. Would you care to tell people about the sponsor of the debate, Resolved God Exists? It's not the philosophy department at Harvard.
No, it's the. It takes place at Memorial Church, and it's sponsored by the Agnostic Chaplaincy of Harvard. And there is an agnostic chaplain who introduces and who MCs or referees or whatever. He has a very, very open mind about everything. He's not going to agree, you know, you're right and you're right and how can you both be right? You're also right, you know, this sort of, which is an old Jewish joke, of course.
Yes.
But he does begin it by saying, you know, here we are, we're at Harvard, and we have the best representative of both sides. So we are going to decide this issue, and the issue is, you know, resolve, God exists. We are going to decide this issue tonight and at Harvard. And so, which struck me as very Harvard, actually.
And got a huge round of applause and laughter, of course.
Yes, right. And whistles, yes.
In the debate itself, realized a huge writerly challenge, because your protagonist was going up against to work as a suspenseful plot, there had to be something hanging in the balance. Couldn't be a slam dunk for your character, especially since the person he's going up against is the character is a Nobel Prize winning economist, author of the book Welfare, Warfare, Wherefore?
Right.
A rational actor
very
analysis
good.
Of
yes.
So the danger is, I mean, you, first of all, if Cass had too easy a time of it, then it would break the spell that that he really was debating a brilliant
economist.
Yeah,
this is like the Rocky moment.
So you
right?
had to, exactly. So, and you know, Rocky can't his opponent. What is it, Apollo Creed? Can't be a pushover.
Exactly.
It's got to be a fair fight.
Exactly.
So you had to put yourself in the shoes, as a writer, of a brilliant neocon economist making the strongest possible argument for God in a way that your readers would find convincing.
And the way I tried to give him the most compelling argument I could think of, you know, which, you know, centered mostly on morality.
And what do you want to share? What that argument was? What you think the best, the best one, the best that the other side can come up with?
Well, I mean, let me just first say that yeah, I had dramatic reasons that it had to be you know, fraught with anxiety. What would
and
happen
kind of,
to poor?
It kind of was. Even.
Well, yes. In fact, as you know, so Steve and I were the entertainment on a cruise for a pro-science, anti-religious group. And I read on the cruise parts, I was still working on it, I think, of that debate.
Yes.
Or maybe I was finished.
Yeah.
And people came up to us afterwards, and this has since happened to me, actually. People have told me, written to me, or in interviews have said, and they were really worried because I made the theist so strong that they didn't see how Cass was going to get out of this. I mean, he really, he brings in David Hume, he brings in the big guns, this theist. And I really tried to make him much, I watched, you can actually find on YouTube these debates, Dinesh D'Souza, and you know, I watched a few of them, and I was very disappointed in the theists. I mean, I thought that they
in
could.
The theists.
Yeah. You know, it's easier.
Atheists didn't do so hot either.
I know.
But.
Yeah. So, but it's, well, you know, when you're up in front of people, it's not so easy to be so smart, right? But I could make them very, very smart, you know, because I was just writing it in the comfort of my house. And so, but I remember, and you remember, people coming up at this thing saying
they were really nervous.
They thought I was switching.
Rocky was going to lose.
They thought I was switching sides or something. Yeah, that it was.
Well,
This
cruise, for me, kind of cemented one of the themes of the book, which is that there is some kind of yearning for what religion provides, whether or not you believe the actual content. Because one of our obligations on this cruise was to have dinner every night with a different table as the entertainment.
And so I told Steve, next time we just pay for a cruise.
So what possesses people? Why join a non-religious religion to not worship a non-existent God?
And to not pray every week.
And one of the things that came out was, I remember especially one guy, there's an extended family, and the pater familias was a kind of no-nonsense guy. He's brought up religious, he just didn't have room for any of it. It struck him as total nonsense. He had no patience for it. But his wife wanted there to be some kind of community, spiritual home for the whole family, some place where they could find community and think, have spiritual experiences. And so the compromise was this humanist freethinker movement, which, I mean, I guess as your character would have predicted, seems to satisfy some yearning above and beyond any theological proposition.
And it's a community that's formed of shared values and belief system, but shared values. You sort of trust these people, and I think that is one of the things that religious communities provide, and other things as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a real, I think, obligation for people who feel strongly about wanting to stamp out religion, which I am not one of those people, but many of the people we know are, to provide something else that's going to satisfy those needs that are going to be there in times of trouble and all of the other things that religion does.
Another, I think, motivation for the religious impulse, which hasn't really been adequately discussed in the literature that I know of the psychology of religion, and that has become, that's the field of your protagonist, and that's become a field in psychology in the last 10 years, trying to explore hypotheses as to why religious belief of various kinds is so compelling. But one of the kinds of question that people find answers to in religion, which seems to be a big theme for your protagonist, are these existential questions that possibly because the human mind isn't constructed to find any answer satisfying, but the kind of questions that that science also doesn't do a very good job of answering, maybe because they're not scientific questions, or maybe they're not even logically coherent questions, mm-hmm. like, why am I here? Why is a brain conscious? How can I have free will? How can morality exist above and beyond conventions and minds and so on? These
Do I really matter?
Do I really matter? All these conundra
yeah.
that just get dizzy the more you think about them.
Yes.
And if you want to look for a place that promises an answer, or at least
yeah.
be with other people who are teasing their brains over the same conundra,
yeah.
then religion is the sphere in which that takes
yeah.
place.
And it is all of these mysteries get buried into that one mystery. It's sort of like one-stop shopping.
For all
religion,
the existential.
Right? For all the, you know, free will, morality, mattering.
Well, I think that's a good transition to the way that we thought we would wrap up this session, which is for Rebecca to do a reading from the novel.
Very short.
A short reading from the novel.
So one of the themes of this thing is that, you know, these religious impulses are so varied and so many and so rooted in human nature that they're not confined to just religious contexts. And we, as you already brought up, we saw that on our cruise, on our anti-religious cruise, that there were aspects of religiosity to it, but there are aspects of religiosity in many, many contexts, academic, romantic, deification of the loved, you know, all of this sort of thing. So that there's more messiness and overlap than appears when you're just being a philosopher and making everything very neat and putting it in argument form. But also, the other side is that these large, what I call ontological wonder, this sense of just glorying and reveling in existence itself, which we can express very naturally, religiously, comes to all of us. And it comes in many secular modes. For me, it comes in mathematics, and for you in science, and for both of us in art and music and literature. And so that's a theme here. So Cass Seltzer, my protagonist, although he's an atheist, Time magazine dubs him the atheist with a soul. And what do I mean? You know, what did they mean by that, or what did I mean by it? You know, he has this capacity for ontological wonder. I'm going to read a little bit of that. Because it's your favorite part.
Yes.
I don't know if you're still doing this, but sometimes I would get up in the middle of the night. Okay. Steve's not in bed. I would come out to his study, and he'd be rereading this part.
Good passage.
This is his part. So what I'll do is I'll just read a little bit from the beginning and then switch over into this introduces one to Cass Seltzer a little bit. All of the chapters are named the argument from something weird. There's the argument from fraught laughter, and this is the argument from the improbable self. Something shifted, something so immense you could call it the world. Call it the world. The world shifted, catching lots of smart people off guard, churning up issues you had thought had settled forever beneath the Earth's crust. The more sophisticated you are, the more annotated your mental life, the more taken aback you're likely to feel, seeing what the world's lurch has brought to light, thrusting up beliefs and desires you had assumed belonged to an earlier stage of human development. What is this stuff, you ask one another, and how can it still be kicking around, given how much we already know? It looks like the kind of relics that archaeologists dig up and dust off, speculating about the beliefs that once had animated them, to the best that they can be reconstructed. Gone as they are now, those thrashings of proto-rationality and mythico-magical hypothesizing, and nearly forgotten. Now it's all gone unforgotten, and minds that have better things to think about have to divert precious neuronal resources to figuring out how to knock some sense back into the species. It's a tiresome proposition, having to take up the work of the Enlightenment all over again, but it's happened on your watch. You ought to have sent up a balloon now and then to get a read on the prevailing cognitive conditions the thinks watching out for the think nots. Now you've gone and let the stockpiling of fallacies reach dangerous levels, and the massed weapons of illogic are threatening the survivability of the globe. None of this is particularly good for the world, but it has been good for Cass Seltzer. That's what he's thinking at this moment, gazing down at the frozen river and regarding the improbable swerve his life has lately taken. He's thinking his life has gotten better because the world has gone bunkers. He's thinking zealots proliferate and Seltzer prospers. It's 4 a.m., and Cass Seltzer is standing on Weeks Bridge, the graceful arc that spans the Charles River near Harvard University, staring down at the river below, which is in the rigor mortis of late February in New England. The whole vista is deserted beyond vacancy, deserted in the way of being inhospitable to human life. There's not a car passing on Memorial Drive, and the elegant river dorms are darkened to silent hulks, the most hyperkinetic of undergraduates, sedated to purring girls and boys. It's not like Cass Seltzer to be out in the middle of an icy night, lost in thought while losing sensation in his extremities. Anyway, this sort of, he's standing there, just, you know, not too far from where we're sitting, and he's in the middle, it's the middle of the night, it's 4 a.m., his girlfriend is away, he's pining after her, poor sucker that he is, and I give him a, you know, I have to make this point that romantic love has bears some of the illusions of religion. So I give him a terrible love life. And he's just duped after one woman after the next. But then, you know, he's standing out there and he's thinking, and he's thinking about the improbable swerve his life has taken. He publishes a book, an atheist bestseller. He's always been obsessed with religion, but now suddenly the world is as well. And so he writes this book, and he's you know, he's living somebody else's life. He gets the bestseller, he gets the girl, Harvard is offering him a job, you know, it's all going great. And he can't believe that this is his life. And so he goes into this kind of state that he's very given to, ontological wonder. If somebody hasn't experienced this particular kind of metaphysical seizure for himself, then it's hard to find the words to give a sense of what it's like. Cass had experienced it as a boy lying in bed and thinking his way into the sense of the strangeness of being just this. Cass had had the lower bunk bed. Both he and Jesse, his younger brother, had wanted the higher bunk. But as usual, Jesse had wanted what he wanted so much more than Cass had wanted it, with a fury of need that was exhausting just to watch, that Cass had let it go. Lying there awake on his lower bunk, Cass would think about being himself rather than being Jesse. There was Jesse, and here was Cass. But if someone were looking at the two of them, Jesse there, Cass here, how could that observer tell that he, Cass, was Cass here and not Jesse there? If it got switched on them, everything the same about them, the body and memories and sense of self and everything else, only now he was Jesse here and there was Cass there, how would anybody know? How would he know? How would Jesse? Maybe a switch had happened. Maybe it happened again and again, and how could anybody tell? The longer he tried to get a fix on the fact of being Cass here, the more the whole idea of it just got away from him. If he tried long enough to grasp it, then he could get the fact of being Cass here to blank out of existence and then come dribbling weakly back in like a fluorescent fixture flickering on and off toward death. He would get the sense of having been shot outside of himself, and now was someone who was regarding his being Cass Seltzer as something like his being in the sixth grade, just something about him that happened to be true. Who was that other that he was who was regarding his being Cass Seltzer as if he didn't have to be Cass Seltzer? The sense of giddiness induced by these exercises could be a bit too overwhelming for a kid in a lower bunk bed. It could be a bit overwhelming still. Should I keep going? But this here I am, Cass is saying, standing on Weeks Bridge and talking aloud into the sublimely indifferent night. Cass knows he needs to tamp down his tendencies toward the transcendent. It isn't becoming an America's favorite atheist who is, at this moment, Cass Seltzer, who is somehow or other just this here. Here great that of all things, one is this thing, so that one can say astonishingly in the right frame of mind, it is astonishing with the metaphysical chill blowing in from afar, here I am. When you didn't force yourself to think in formal reconstructions, when you didn't catch these moments of ravishments under the lens of premises and conclusions, when you didn't impale them and label them like so many splayed butterflies bleeding the transcendental glow right out of them, then what? More? It's even hard at a time like this to resist the shameful narcissistic appeal of reasonings like the argument from personal coincidences, number 8, and the argument from answered prayers, number 9, and the argument from a wonderful life, number 10. William James had rebuked the scoundrel logic that calculates divine providence from one's own goody bag of gains, and Cass couldn't agree more with the spirit of James. But here it is, his bulging goody bag, and call him a scoundrel for feeling personally grateful for the universe when at this same moment that he's standing on Weeks Bridge and tossing hosannas out into the infinite universe, there are multitudes of others whose lives are painfully constricting with misfortunes that are just as arbitrary and undeserved as his own expansive good luck. But Cass Seltzer does feel grateful. At moments like this, could Cass altogether withstand the sense that, hard to put it into words, the sense that the universe is personal, that there's something personal that grounds existence and order and value and purpose and meaning, and that the grandeur of that personal universe has somehow infiltrated and it's expanding his own small person, bringing his littleness more into line with its grandeur, that the personal universe has been personally kind to him, gracious and forgiving to Cass Seltzer, gratuitously, exorbitantly, divinely kind, and this despite Cass's having, with callowness and shallowness of forethought, thrown spitballs at the whole idea of cosmic intentionality? No, that doesn't capture it either. Those words are far too narrow by Cass's own particular life, when what it is he could feel, has felt, might even be feeling now, has nothing to do with the contents of Cass's existence, but rather with existence itself. This expansion out into the world, which is a kind of love, he supposes, a love for the whole of existence that could so easily well up in Cass Seltzer at this moment, standing here in the pure abstractions of this night and contemplating the strange thisness of his life when viewed sub specie aeternitatis, that is to say, from the vantage point of eternity, which comes so highly recommended to us by Spinoza. Here it is, then, the sense that existence is just such a tremendous thing. One comes into it astonishingly. Here one is, formed by biology and history, genes and culture, in the midst of the contingency of the world. Here one is. One doesn't know how and one doesn't know why, and suddenly one doesn't know where one is either, or who or what one is either, and all that one knows is that one is a part of it, a considered and conscious part of it, generated and sustained in existence in ways one can hardly comprehend, all the time conscious of it, though, of existence, the fullness of it, the reaching expanse and pulsing intricacy of it. And one wants to live in a way that at least begins to do justice to it. One wants to expand one's reach of it as far as expansion is possible, and even beyond that, to live one's life in a way commensurate with the privilege of being a part of and conscious of the whole reeling, glorious, infinite sweep. A sweep that includes so improbably a psychologist of religion named Cass Seltzer, who, moved by powers beyond himself, did something more improbable than all the improbabilities constituting his improbable existence could have entailed, did something that won him someone else's life, a better life, a more brilliant life, a life beyond all the ones he had wished for in the pounding obscurity of all his yearnings, because all of this, couldn't belong to him, to the man who stands on Weak Bridge, wrapped around in a scarf his once-beloved ex-wife Pascal had knit for him for some necessary reason that he would never know, perhaps to offer him some protection against the desolation she knew would soon be his, and was, but is no longer, suspended here above sublimity, his cheeks aflame with either euphoria or frostbite, a letter in his zippered pocket with the imprimatur of Veritas, and a Lucinda Mandelbaum with whom to share it all.
Yeah, I enjoyed your both of your presentations very much. I was very intrigued by the connection between the euthyphro and ideas about morality, and I want to ask a question that's ultimately a question about Spinoza. The euthyphro can be taken to give us a secular view about morality, that it's moral relativism, that human beings, that something is moral because human beings believe it. And then the moral realist counterpart with that, this would be secular, is that human beings believe something is moral because it is moral. But there's a deistic counterpart to that, which is the one that is actually in the euthyphro. God does, something is good because God endorses it, which would be a kind of deistic relativism, versus something, God endorses something because it's moral. Now, there is a coherent position. Deistic relativism is a coherent position. You could say that God has no constraints on him whatsoever, and that whatever he says goes. He could make genocide moral tomorrow. That's a coherent position. Yeah. Somebody like Jonathan Edwards, I think, had a position like that, right? Yeah. Now, that seems to me a coherent position, too quickly refuted, as I heard you lay it out. And I wonder whether it's not something like what Spinoza himself believed, because, you know, he was sort of either a God-intoxicated man or an atheist, but he seemed like his refutation of the problem of evil was that God doesn't really care about us. We just don't loom that large for him. So couldn't Spinoza have had a deistic relativism that would be an argument in favor of God and the connection between God and morality?
Excellent. I think when we are asking this question, how do we ground morality objectively, it is because those who feel this question keenly want to do justice to their intuition that there is an objective morality, and they bring in God to do that. And so the euthyphro argument is simply a way of saying it's not going to help you out of relativism. And so if you want to bring in a sort of deistic relativism, that would be fine. I mean, I think maybe the response would be then why don't we just drop the word morality. It might be, it's a pragmatic ought. It's in your self-interest to do the things that God wants you to do. Not it doesn't give you morality, but it's in your, you know, like it's in my self-interest to, you know, do what my boss wants because there will be repercussions if I don't. So there's a kind of pragmatic ought. But this, that kind of look, whatever God says, this just simply constitutes morality. It's going to give you a kind of pragmatic ought. It's not, doesn't seem that it's going to give you what one is after. That is, those who are bringing theism in order to ground, to justify their intuition that there really is an objective morality. Yeah, but, you know, it's not going to give you any, it's not going to, first of all, it's not going to give you great guidance in what that God wants, because, I mean, we have these various views of God, and you know, God, you know, I was brought up, and God did not want me to eat milk until I waited 6 hours after meat, right? That's after I had ingested meat, and God was going to be very, very upset with me if I did that, whereas my next-door neighbor, who was Italian Catholic, didn't have that view of God, and so, you know, had a quite different one. And so, you know, I mean, it's just more, it's chaos. It's not going to help one here. And I would also want to claim that Spinoza, whose great work is called, his magnum opus is called The Ethics, is trying to lay down an objective grounding, not theistic, but an objective grounding for, and he does it quite well. I mean, I'd have to give you a whole lecture on it, but he does it extraordinarily well, and doing justice to this core intuition that we all have. If we're committed to our lives, and Spinoza has a Latin term for that, conitas, you know, my commitment to my life, the thing that makes me, the thing that he's struggling after, what makes him, the thing that makes me is, of all the things in the world, there is one thing that I don't have to offer any justification for, no reason for why I want it to flourish, and that's me. That is the core of what makes me me. And as long as one has that, Spinoza tries to go to work on one and get one to get out of this logically, if you follow it through, the ethics. That's what the program is about, whether it works or not, but that's what it's about. So he really is trying to give us an objective morality.
That's amazing. It almost seems to me, and I apologize since I'm not a philosopher, this is naive, but it seems that if one was going to offer some characterization of what of morality, a grounding of it, you'd want it to at least agree on a few clear cases so that you could have confidence in saying it is a theory of morality as opposed to the rules of hockey or the rules of Monopoly or any arbitrary rule system. And so you'd want to anchor it in a few cases that everyone would agree, well, that's got to be moral. So torturing an innocent child, that's got to, whatever your system is, it's got to put that on the immoral side. And saving someone from drowning, that's surely got to be on the moral side. And that's kind of our benchmark for even counting something as a theory of morality. So it seems to me that the deistic relativism would just fail that test. That is, there aren't any generally agreed upon clear cases for which it would reliably even sort them into the right piles, in which case you could say, well, yeah, it's a theory, it's a rule system, it might even be internally cohesive, but why should we even call it a theory of morality if we can't tie it to at least the cases that we associate the word with?
And in fact, this is where I thought you might also be going, was that the Bible itself, there are cases in which torturing a child is okay. and I think, yeah, if you're Jewish, can you save somebody who's not Jewish when they're drowning?
On Shabbos?
I'm not sure. But I'm sure the rabbis discuss it.
I'm sure they discussed it, yeah.
I had a college roommate who was a gung-ho Ayn Rand fan. He was a flaming, stony-hearted libertarian and a dogmatic free marketeer. And I, at the time, was a bleeding-heart utopian socialist. And I couldn't. All throughout the whole year, we would argue about morality. Why care about other people? And I never made any inroads. I never got him to move an inch. And afterwards, too late. Well, many years afterwards, I discovered that Adam Smith has a moral psychology based on sympathy. He says there actually is an innate faculty of feeling other people's emotions, sharing other people's emotions imaginatively. And that this really is a ground, an objective, a physical ground for altruism, benevolence, for morality. As a psychologist and someone who knows a great deal about evolution, is there a physiological basis for morality along those lines? And as a philosopher, does that cut it with you?
Yeah, I'll start. Yeah, I think Smith was, in many regards, way ahead of his time in not only identifying this emotion or motive that we undoubtedly feel, but also circumscribing its limits. And I think it may have been even the same passage in which he says, identifies the problem of relying only on our sense of sympathy. I think he said, if I was in an accident and I lost the tip of my finger, that would like really upset me. It would just, you know, bum me out. It would just color my mood for a long time. I open the paper and I read of an earthquake in China, and 300,000 people are killed. And I read it and I kind of shake my head and I think, oh, that's really too bad. And I put the newspaper down and then I don't think about it again. Why would my little finger way more on me than the lives of 500,000 people in China. And so I think what he, I mean, this is a maybe an anachronistic reading, but I think he identifies both the germ or the kernel of a moral sense, but also why it isn't enough. Namely, that our sense of sympathy or empathy or feeling other people's pain by default is just too narrow compared to what we could rationally justify as what it ought to be. And I think religion tries to step into that vacuum, but I think Spinoza and Kant and other universalist moral systems do the same by saying that whatever feeling you might have for your family, your little finger, your lover, your friend, you ought to broaden it. There's no reason that your own narrow circle of familiarity should be where your sense of sympathy ends. So, and I think Smith got both sides of this, that there really is, an innate basis of morality in all but the psychopath, but that what evolution gave us, again, to be anachronistic, needs a lot of bulking up by moral argumentation, discourse, example, and so on.
And imagination as well. I mean, one of the ways in which the circle of empathy has been widened is the vivid representation of what it is like, what it feels like to be the other person. And art has, in fact, and particularly the written narrative arts, that's their subject matter, have done a lot to enliven. We're very good at knowing our own pain, imagining the pain of those who are closest and dearest to us, whose genes we want to survive us, our children, and our friends and those like us. But when it gets far away from us, it gets much, much harder. And one of the things, of course, that this form has done, the novel, is to show the inside, the internal, and how we're all like. I mean, the story, of course, about how Harriet Beecher Stowe, with Uncle Tom's Cabin, changed the perceptions of this country, and whether it's apocryphal or not, that Lincoln, when he met her, said, "So you're the little lady who started this great big war." I don't know if he really said it, but it's a great story, and there's a lot of truth to that as well. So, when you're saying that it's not what empathy gives us is not what it ought to give us, right there, he's making the distinction between psychology and morality. That psychology can't do it all. Psychology also gives men an instinct to leave their seed all over the place, right? And to rape and pillage. The evolutionary explanation is never sufficient.
I just want to add something, because I think all of us had a roommate or someone that we knew who was obsessed with Ayn Rand. I was in a bicycle accident, and I cut my knee, and I was in the emergency room, and a guy, the intern, recognized me for one of my books and said, "Oh, have you ever read, I forget whether it was Atlas Shrugged or The Fountainhead," and he pulled out a copy and he kind of foisted it on me. And there I was, bleeding from my knee. I wasn't going to argue with him then and there. But there are these fanatics, and the thing is that the Ayn Randianism, which has gotten a lot of attention this last year, because I think it's, 100th birthday or something?
I mean, it's selling very well.
Well,
still.
It's one of the best-selling books of all time.
Yeah.
But some of my best friends are libertarians, and they reassure me that, in fact, Ayn Rand is not what most libertarians think of as their intellectual inspiration, that they trace it more to classical liberal thinking, like Adam Smith and Hume and John Stuart Mill and so on, and that Rand, interestingly, it is a kind of secular religion, even though she was obviously militantly atheist. But it has a lot of the trappings of religion. There is the prophet. There, it has a feel of a cult. It is probably intellectually closer to Nietzsche than classical liberalism, and very much very different from Bob Nozick and Friedrich Hayek and the Milton Friedman and the real libertarian inspirations. But I mean, it's probably has its own iconography. It has a demonology. I think it's a really good example of everything that you don't want in religion in this belief system that happens to be atheistic.
Yeah. Yeah. And an ethical system.
An ethical system, yeah. And in that way, it's also like other, I think, totalizing ideologies communism.
Yeah.
And all of which were fascism, which were all contemporary. All of these non-religious belief systems that had all of the worst aspects of religion packed into them.
Yeah. Having given us a fairly vivid account of your cruise, I'm interested in what the psychologist and the artist both would have to say, what more they would each have to say about the desire for community separated from religion. What is that desire of community really about, especially from an evolutionary point of view, once survival is not as large an issue looming in one's life? What is that desire for community about?
Well, evolutionarily, it's Homo sapiens is a social species, and there's no such thing as any group of people that just live in the woods as solitons, just solitary, that people hang about together. But the part of the psychological manifestation is it's not that we're social because we're kind of robots who must be social. What it means to be a social species is to have certain emotions. In fact, William James was quite explicit about this. He was really the first evolutionary psychologist, very much influenced by Darwin. But I think one of James's great contributions is that we often think of evolutionary imperatives as these robotic drives. But really what they are is emotions, that there's something that it feels like if you're a hen and you want to sit on an egg. It's not like you're a robot. It's just the most precious and wonderful and never to be too much sat upon thing in the universe if you're a hen. Likewise, if you're a social species, the way that's actually implemented is you like people. You feel lonely when you're not with people. You fall in love. You love your children. You love your parents and your brothers and your sisters. You form friendships. You form alliances. And subjectively, they all feel like communal love. The fact that they may have an evolutionary rationale in terms of reciprocal altruism, namely, in the long run, people do better off if they exchange favors than if they don't, is a separate level of analysis. That's how we can explain why people have love of their community. But as they experience it, it's the desire to be with other people. It's the desire to share things, to help them out and be helped in return. And it's as much a part of human nature as eating and sexuality and fear and the other emotions.
I once read that there is some optimal number above which it no longer feels like a community. And it has something to do with the hunter-gatherer.
Oh, yes.
75.
Robin Dunbar, that's right.
Yeah.
The idea is there's, I think it's like usually a small circle of 50 interacting with a larger circle of circles of about 500. And so the kind of harmonic mean between them is about 150.
Yeah.
That's generally the size of effective. Is that right? Tribal.
Tribal.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I was curious, you've described the development of moral philosophy as kind of people's attempts to justify and do justice to their innate moral instincts. But as I imagine you discovered when you got caught into the sort of atheism, theism wars, one of the first arguments for an external source for morality that comes out is, you know, if we didn't have an external morality, people would turn into monsters and kill each other. You know, a sort of alarmingly sociopathic theory of human nature. Do you think there's any serious current of moral philosophy that's more spurred on by fear of the weakness of our moral instincts rather than inspired by their existence? Or is that just a more or less instrumental, you know, if the atheists come, we'll say that atheism turns you into a murderer and is thus a menace to the community. You know, is that an actual current in moral philosophy, or is that just a surface argument that happens to come up for spurious reasons?
Yeah. So there are two, you know, there are the two different arguments. One is, how do we ground morality? And the second question is, and how do we get people to be moral? And does anybody become a better person by reading Kant or Spinoza? I think yes. And I think, in fact, that society has made progress because these people were read and their ideas got worked into governments, in fact, and into societal rules. But the notion that without an enforcer, a heavenly enforcer, you know, watching all the time, making sure that we're not going to, you know, even if we get away with it, we're really not getting away with it. That notion of that's what we need in order to be moral is, I have to just say, I always, when people make that argument to me, I give them a lot of distance. and I think it's basically, it's an empirical argument. It's really in your sphere. I mean, maybe studies have been done, but I mean, I would really like to see, you know, the morality, how much charity giving is done, and how much, you know, altruistic acts, and, well, I mean, charity, of course, can be measured when it's religious communities as opposed to, you know, other communities. I spent my whole life in academia, which is, you know, for the most part, not a religious community. It has its own aspects of religiosity, but it's not a religious community. And I, you know, there are moral people, there are immoral people. I have never just, you know, personally, empirically, noticed that much of a difference. But it's really an empirical question, isn't it? What happens when people lose their religion? Do they all become, you know, hedonists, rapists, murder? I mean, I don't see it. I don't see this happening.
I suspect that there's probably not going to be an answer that would put all the believers of religion on one side and all the atheists on the other, because, you know, you have people who are deeply religious who will fly airplanes into skyscrapers and burn witches, but they're also Quakers who want to stamp out slavery and war. And likewise, among atheists, there's you know, Mao and Stalin, but then there's also the founders of the Republic and the people who come on our cruise who are perfectly nice people, wouldn't
well,
hurt a fly,
nice
give
yes.
money to charity. So
I mean,
I suspect
thing,
it's not
the,
a,
yeah.
it won't, the empirical question would probably yeah. depend on the community.
I mean, the other thing is that to do good because you're going to get a reward from daddy, heavenly daddy, or if you not do bad because you're going to get a really bad spanking, to me, this is not mature morality. This is not morality worthy of us. We can do better.
Well, I guess the anti-religious cruise was not as savage and hedonistic as perhaps I thought
it
might be.
It was a bore.
anyway, on that note, I would like to thank everyone for coming and.